listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Yes, you are, and I'm Michael Sterling.
And I'm not.
No, you're not.
But I wish I was,
as you are always. Paul Strolley,
I am Paul Strolley, yes. Welcome to State of the Arts.
Indeed, and Paul, we'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, Breakdown Services. Breakdown Services is the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, please visit them at BreakdownExpress.com.
Our thanks also go out to PerformingArtsLive.com for their ongoing support of our live arts calendar. PerformingArtsLive.com is the most comprehensive such listing service in Southern California, enabling you to search events by date, category, and region.
And we'd like to remind our listeners that, of course, the destruction in Japan continues.
There's an earthquake today.
Yes, another earthquake today.
6.6, yeah.
And we urge all of our listeners to assist in the worldwide concern by donating whatever you can. And to do so, please go to your computers and contact one of the following organizations: redcross.org, worldvision.org/helpjapan, or disasterfunding.org.
And as Michael said, all of these links are available at www.stateoftheartsla.com. We put a little banner up there just to make it easier for you. So stateoftheartsla.com, scroll down to the bottom of the page and click Donate to Japan. It is obviously well worth it and our responsibility and our humanitarian effort. So we have a couple of in-studio guests very excited
about.
Can I tell people about it?
Please, Paul, go.
Okay, starting off, joining us in studio today, actor, ping pong aficionado, and French horn prodigy, Scott Lowell is with us. Let's give it up for Mr. Lowell, okay? There he is.
That's what you selected.
Yes. Well, I had a couple for you, but I didn't want to use the other one. Would you like to hear the other
Please,
one?
Please, yes.
Sure.
That's better with the French horn.
And I have a better one for our next guest, too. We also have award-winning director who will tell us all about his current world premiere hit, Having It All. Happy to have him here. Richard Israel is with us.
Nice.
What'd you think?
Very impressive.
Well, yeah. Michael is rolling his eyes because he's like, Paul, we got to get more sound bites.
Yes.
You've done the same five for 46 shows now?
46 shows.
Yes. Yeah. So we have to get new little, but
it's
some
time.
Of them are, you know, and I just try to tuck them in where they won't be noticed. So. Anyway, so Michael, how was your week?
It was interesting. I think today actually was well, first of all, it was interesting. I went to a wonderful show over the weekend, The Producers at Cabrillo Music Theater.
They had two of their stars last week here.
We did, David Engel and Larry Rabin, and the show was directed by our good friend Steve Glaudini.
Yes.
From Musical Theater West, and I must say, gentlemen, I'd never seen the show.
What?
I'd never seen the show.
Yeah. And I think that producer show has legs. I think it's going to do well.
I think it will. 12 Tonys later. No, it was a wonderful production, and David and Larry were superb. Of course, they've been doing these roles for a long time.
Sure.
Larry having replaced Matthew Broderick on Broadway in that role of Leo Bloom. But Cabrillo always turns in such great work. And one of the other cast members was also from the Broadway production, the young lady that played Ula. Am I saying that right? Mm-hmm. Is that the character's name?
Yes.
How stunning was she, first of all, visually to look at. Sarah Cornell, actually, is her name. And the audience was in heaven, as was I. And I just want to shout out that, you know, continue doing the great work over there, Louis Wilkenfeld, and we shall all be there.
All right.
Yeah,
all
absolutely.
Right.
Go and see it.
I was unable to make it.
I know you were.
Because I'm just too busy.
Yeah.
I'm too busy, Michael, I'm telling you.
Well,
just,
you're
you know,
all
between you're... between the crack and my other various addictions. You know, it's a difficult time for me. So
it was almost a difficult time for me, Paul.
Yes, you told me. Do tell what happened on your way here today.
On the way here, driving down Coldwater Canyon, and I was turning onto Coldwater Canyon, and of course, coming in the opposite direction, also turning the same way on Coldwater Canyon, was a policeman on a motorcycle. And I don't know if you guys are like me, but when I see a policeman, my body goes rigid because I'm certain that I've done something wrong or I will be doing something wrong.
Mine goes rigid too, but it's usually the pepper spray that does it for me.
So I got all tense and I'm, you know, then of course I don't see him at all. And I think, wow, that was quick. He's disappeared already. And then I'm driving a little bit further and I notice him before I notice him, I actually, my hands with this weather have gotten really dry, so I keep a little bit of lotion in my car. And
this is bad written all over.
Yeah. This is why? Yes.
So I get the lotion out of the compartment, and I
say that
you know
so
how
many
you
times. So many times.
If I had a nickel for every time I had a show.
But you
I'm
know,
sorry, would you say that again? If I had a nickel.
But you know, when you're doing that, you're putting some lotion on your hands, don't you always put just a little bit too much? And
sure.
I certainly do. And so I did that. I'm relieving my dry hands and also relieved at the fact that the policeman is no more in sight.
The show has changed so much.
So I go a little bit further and I see the policeman wedged himself between two large cars, and one being a truck and one being a van, so that nobody could see him. So I'm driving forward and I'm happily, you know, moistening my hands, and I am looking in the rearview mirror, and all of a sudden, there he is. He's behind, and the lights are going, and I had just gotten through not only putting it on my hands, but all over my face, and my knee.
Because you had too much on your hands.
Yes, too much on my hands, and my knee is driving the wheel. And I freaked out. I said, oh, my God, I might as well just be on my cell phone in plain sight. Yeah. And here it goes. I'm going to get a ticket. I'm going to be late. Paul's going to be upset with me.
Because moistening is an offense.
Like, yes, exactly. And sure enough, he's after the car right behind me.
Yep.
Pulls over, and I feel so relieved.
This coming from the guy who his car is like this testament to electronics. If he goes in and he breathes in a certain tone, the phone will go on. If he exhales on an F sharp, it dials a certain person. He could conduct, you know, a massive, you know, financial transaction in his car with just the power of his voice. Yet he will lotion both hands and his face while driving.
Yeah.
It's just like, come
I feel
on.
Safe on the roads.
Yeah, do you?
Well, the whole story sounded like everything could have been a euphemism.
Yes, no, it was. Well, that's just it.
The cop wedging himself between the...
Everything had a double entendre.
I think you need to replay that later and just put in euphemisms.
I think we should just isolate the sound bites out of context.
There's more sound bites.
Yes, exactly. Get the lotion out of the compartment.
And coming up next, he was wedged between two vehicles. And before we go to commercial, so I put some on my face.
Wow.
Hands flailing.
Well, there you go. What kind of show is this?
Exactly.
I have to comment on that, though, because it's funny that you said that, because I don't know if either of you read this in LA Weekly, but about, I think it was about 2 months ago, a motorcycle cop hit the back of a car that stopped short, and LAPD is so embarrassed by the whole thing because the guy was pulling through a light, and a motorcycle cop behind the car flipped on his siren and all that, and the car panicked, and he slammed on the brakes, and the motorcycle guy hit the back of the car and went up and wound up in the back seat because it was a convertible with his legs sticking straight up. And someone took a cell phone photo of this and it went viral.
Oh.
And so now the whole LAPD thing is like, no, it's in every other scenario, it's the fault of the vehicle behind that hits the vehicle.
Right, right.
Unless, of course, it's a cop, in which case it's the fault of the person in front.
Was there lotion involved in that one? Do we think?
All I know is that when they pulled the guy over, it puts the lotion on and then it puts it in the basket. That's what it was.
Wow.
Let's talk about nicer things.
Really? Oh. Wait, that was bordering on the pornographic.
The legs were up in the air.
Border.
It probably looked like an outtake of the all-male adult feature the village people hit the road, you know, with just the cop leg sticking up. Our first guest not only won a critical acclaim and a legion of loyal fans for his work on Showtime's groundbreaking hit series Queer as Folk, but is currently starring alongside Gary Cole, Philip Baker Hall, Orlando Jones, and Mayim Bialik in the soon-to-be-released feature film The Chicago 8. Welcome a great friend of State of the Arts, Mr. Scott Lowell.
Please, thank you. Sit down. Sit down.
So,
thank you.
Mom, sit down.
Scott, welcome.
Mom, I told you to wait in the car.
Nice to have you back, sir.
It's lovely to be back. Thank you.
Mayim Bialik.
Why'd you go all FM on us? Did you just went all
I
FM, did,
kind
DJ?
Of. I'm jealous of his voice right now. I'm like,
well,
oh, great.
It's because if I wear these, I can't help it.
That's true. You just, it becomes like bathroom acoustics.
You become in love with yourself.
It's like, hello, you know, I don't often talk this
time. I might have to borrow the lotion later.
See, that's too
put it in the basket!
Too many years on Queer as Folk.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I can turn it on and off.
Yes.
So yes.
Everything uttered on the show will have a double entendre.
Yes, it will.
You've never, I tell you, you don't know double entendre until you've seen a drag queen sing My Way. Because every single line, I'm telling you, every single line of My Way has a double entendre, meaning when a 6 foot two drag queen is saying, I faced the wall, but I stood tall and did it. Yes, hysterical. Anyway.
Yes.
So now I watched the trailer for Chicago 8. Now,
yes.
you just attended the screening. It's not going to be released till October, right?
I don't know when it's going to be released. Yeah, it was screened at the Beverly Hills Film Festival last week, and I think it's been at a couple other film festivals. I don't know what's going on with it.
And the response has been great. Huh?
The response has been really positive to it. You know, it's a great story. And I had done the stage version of it now almost 20 years ago back in Chicago.
Oh, really?
With Remains Theater Company. They did a production of it. It started out here back in the 70s down at the Odyssey. Ron Sassi and Frank Condon created this thing, and they did it there. And when we did it in Chicago, it was the first time it had actually been done in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
It was 91, I think. So, yeah, so 20
so
years
now,
ago.
So now, is the play, because I know if you look at things like the Caine Mutiny or the Caine Mutiny Court-Martial,
yeah,
where the play of the Caine Mutiny film is, it all takes place in the courtroom.
Yes.
Is the play all in the
play
courtroom?
Is all in the courtroom, and it's all very docudrama, you are there kind of stuff, and it's all just court transcripts. It's just directly listed from the court transcript. You don't need to, I mean, what went on during this trial back in 69 and 70 was so dramatic and so insane that you didn't need to add anything to it.
Really?
I played, when I did it 20 years ago, I was one of the defendants. I was Rennie Davis, and now I'm aged a little and I've become the man, and now I'm trying to put those damn hippies away.
Yeah, right.
So it was really interesting to kind of come to the story from the complete opposite sides and revisit it in that way. When we did it in Chicago, you know, it was 81. It was a good, you know, 10 or 11 years after the event, and emotions were still high. People who came to the show, because you were very much, I mean, audience members were frisked when they came in by bailiffs, and you felt like you were at this trial, and we had a number of emotional outbursts during the show.
Really?
from audience members. One guy who stormed out screaming, "Damn communists!" and ran out, and
This was 81.
This was not. Actually, I'm sorry, 91. So my math is off.
Yeah.
So 20 years later, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing experience. And actually, my single most, I don't like doing favorites when people ask me, you know, what's your favorite this or what's your favorite that. I can never do it because it changes all the time. But my single favorite performance of a show happened during the run of that play, because it was so visceral. And it was a student matinee, and the reaction of the students to seeing this story that they had no idea about, and the kind of things that actually, you know, go on in our court system and how people were treated.
But that's saying something there too, Scott, because I mean, you think about it, for those of us who have done shows, you know, the old student matinee
is usually
hardly a high watermark for the performances, because usually they're apathetic or they're just
right. And this was amazing, and it was an amazing mix of and we should maybe we can talk about what, you know, the trial was for those who don't know it, but the audience was a mix of students from inner city schools, from, you know, schools from Highland Park, which is a more affluent suburb of Chicago, from, you know, they were really from all over the city. And the way they came together, the way this story force them as an audience to bond and respond and end up holding hands and things like that. I mean, was extraordinary and left me kind of weeping during the show.
Wow.
Where I shouldn't have. And then the talk back afterwards as well was very moving. And, you know, it was around an election time and, you know, how it empowered these kids in a way. And I actually was thinking about over the weekend when I'm sorry, now the name has gone out of my head, as things often happen. Sidney Lumet who passed away.
Yes.
And I was watching his the very odd video obituary he did with the New York Times, where they interviewed him, I guess, a couple years ago, knowing that this would be aired as his obituary. It's a new thing they're doing, I guess.
Really?
Where they interview people who they think may be near death or something. I don't know. But they interviewed Sidney Lumet, and it was specifically only meant to be aired as part of his obituary. And he knew, and he kind of references it that even during it, because they asked him some questions, because he, you know, pondered, and they asked him, you know, what do you want to be remembered for? And then they were also asking him, you know, do you think art and film, I think they were talking about specifically with him, you know, has the power to change people? And he kind of pondered. He said, well, this is going to be viewed after I'm dead, right? I said, yeah. And he thought about it. He said, well, then honestly, no, I don't think it does, which really shocked me. And yeah. I thought about this performance and I thought, well, no, I think it does. And especially, you know, in the atmosphere we are now, where, you know, the arts are being cut left and right and we're in danger of so many things. I felt like it was... I was disappointed that that's how he felt, but obviously it must be how he really felt, because he didn't care what anybody thought, because he'd be dead when we found out. Right. But, you know, I thought about this performance in this play and how it really affected these kids' lives. I know it did. And so.
Oh, yeah. No, that's I disagree with that, too. I mean, in terms of it not really affecting people, there's a great story of when they did Waiting for Godot. The first time they did Waiting for Godot with E.G. Marshall and Burt Lahr.
Yeah.
And they did it at some, like, basically...
In Florida, right?
In Florida, like a dinner theater in Florida. And no one knew what to make of it. And it was trounced. It got terrible reviews. And Beckett just said, do it in a prison. Bring it to a prison. And because it's about two guys and down on their luck, and they played it in a prison, and they raised the roof. And to this day, actually, I don't know if it was San Quentin or not, but the two terms, a go-go and a Didi for Estragon and Vladimir, mm-hmm. those nicknames are still in the vernacular of San Quentin prison, if depending on what type of personality you are.
That's
so don't tell me that does not affect people's lives.
I agree.
It was first done at the Burt Reynolds Dinner Theater.
I don't think that went over too
well in Florida.
Yes.
They all had to wear mustaches.
But I like the frisking part now. You said they frisked the audience.
Yes, they did, but there was no lotion involved.
No, there would be.
Damn it.
They would. We had the actors who played bailiffs in the show, and the trial basically
was, you mentioned that, Scott. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you mentioned, for those that were listening that do not know the premise, just can you give a little synopsis?
This was absolutely, you know, during the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968, a number of hippies and yippies and other student organizations formed a rally, which they wanted to call the Festival of Life, that was going to take place in Grant Park in Chicago. And they had applied for permits to stay in the park, and the city government was nervous about this and denied the permits, but the kids decided to stay in the park anyway. And under Mayor Daley I, the police were ordered to essentially go in there and kind of beat the hell out of these kids and get them out of the park no matter what. And so all those famous kind of images you see whenever you talk about the Vietnam War and the protests that went on, of the blue helmets going, the baby blue helmets going in just bludgeoning kids in the park, and that all took place during this. So as a result of everything that went on in the park, who the government decided were the organizers of this event were put on trial for a conspiracy to cross state lines and incite riots, that they came here deliberately to cause these problems. And the people they chose, most of them, a lot of them hadn't met ever before the trial began, actually. Instantly defies the fact that it was a conspiracy. But, you know, the more famous of them were Abbie Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Tom Hayden, Bobby Seale. Bobby Seale was thrown on. Bobby Seale was chairman of the Black Panther Party at the time, and was kind of tossed on. He was actually a last-minute replacement at the festival. He wasn't in any way involved, but they had lost a speaker, and but the government had been trying to get him for a while, and he was already wanted on a possible murder conviction back in New Haven, my hometown. So they kind of tacked him onto the trial as the eighth, because some people know the trial as the trial of the Chicago Seven.
Yeah.
But originally it was the Chicago Eight because Bobby Seale was attached to it. And the story of Bobby Seale, which is handled very, very nicely in the film, and Orlando Jones plays Bobby Seale. Bobby Seale's lawyer was undergoing, I believe, kidney surgery at the time the trial was supposed to start, and he had asked for a delay in the trial, and the government and the judge would not allow it. So during the course of the trial, he continually asked, for the right to represent himself, which is, I believe, a constitutional right.
Yeah.
And the judge kept denying that claim, and so fights would break out in the middle of the court. I mean, there was constantly fights breaking out with bailiffs just punching guys in the nuts and knocking them down, and it was really rough. And the arguments and the fights between the Judge Hoffman and Bobby Seale got so rough that the judge finally ordered Bobby Seale dragged out of the room, and they had built a special chair for him that he was shackled to and gagged and brought into the courtroom. And you can see, I mean, the courtroom drawings of this. I mean, it's horrifying. And when we did the play, we ran it for a while, and every night, I mean, the hair would stand up on my arm. You just can't believe this went on
that actually took
in a courtroom, but it did, and he was forced to sit there. And then eventually, because the gag didn't work well enough, he was kicked out of the trial altogether. And so that's what went on. And it went on from 69, I can't remember the start date, but into, I think, about February 1970. Most of the conspiracy charges were found not guilty on, but because there was so much contempt of court that went on, I mean, every 5 seconds the judge was shouting these damn hippies down, and they were fighting back. And even the lawyer, William Kunstler, who's a very famous lawyer, was sentenced, I think, to 4 years in jail under contempt. None of them served that long time. They ended up getting out on bail, and things ended up being overturned because it was just a kangaroo court in there. But that's the essential trial. And what was being put on trial really was the lifestyle of the hippies and the protesters at the time, and that's what this really was about.
Yeah, in the late 60s when, Malcolm X had just been executed.
Malcolm X, Bobby Kennedy.
Or shot at.
I mean, they're really, and that was, especially doing the show in Chicago and talking to people, I actually became friendly with William, the name is...
William F. Buckley?
William F. Buckley, who's a very dear friend. No,
William Frawley, Fred Mertz.
No, Bill Ayers. William. I know
William
him as Bill.
Ayers.
William Ayers, who was one of the head of the Weathermen, and
you're a communist.
I am a communist, and who caused Obama such trouble in the last election. But I got to know him through my fiance at the time, who was a teacher and had worked with Bill, and I talked with him a lot about stuff because he knew these guys and knew stuff was going on, and he talked a lot about how that sense of despair of having lost John Kennedy, then Martin Luther King is assassinated, and especially in the late 60s, that period of time when you lose Martin Luther King, you lose Bobby Kennedy, you lose Malcolm X, and the sense that people were having of this government is shutting down. I mean, the world is blowing up. What is going on?
And
all this hope that was just lost and devastated, and this real feel that there needed to be a revolution. I mean, it's oddly kind of like what's going on in the Middle East in some ways, but that sense of that, that there, we need to change things, and that's what they were fighting for. And so it's a story that a lot of people were passionate about. And this film, to kind of, I guess, get to the actual point, is, it was not a big budget affair, but it attracted, Philip Baker Hall, who plays the judge, Gary Cole, who plays Kunstler, Orlando Jones, Danny Masterson plays Jerry Rubin, Thomas Ian Nicholas plays Abby Hoffman.
And Mayim Bialik?
Mayim Bialik plays Jerry Rubin's girlfriend. She's very funny in it. And Stephen Culp plays my fellow prosecutor. This amazing cast of people who came together with an Israeli director, producer, writer, Pincus Perry, who used to be an attorney and was just so passionate about this story himself that he wanted to do and put up his own money to do this film. But, I mean, everybody came to do it because this story still resonates and still matters, and especially in a time when you want more people to kind of rise up and speak out against things that are going on, it's nice to be reminded these things happened and that you have to fight back against a government sometimes that's trying to put you down.
No, just and I watched a trailer earlier today, and people should. The Chicago 8 trailer, I just did a search for it on Google. It's on, I think it's on YouTube, but it's very, you talked about that, you know, just like it's, it does not look like a courtroom drama. People are just getting pummeled left and right.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not, you know, and it was like that. I mean, you can read any book or any description of these things, and it, you know, was an amazing thing that was going on. The absolute struggle for life or death that was going on, and you have the old guard trying to hold on. You know, kind of similar to some, you know, white old rich men now who are still trying to hold, you know, hold on to this country from, you know, strange black men who are now running it.
You know,
I mean, it's that same thing. It's these death throes of an old way, and they're not going to go easily.
Right.
And and the younger generation trying to come in and say, no, we want to change things. And
more timely than you would expect.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very much so.
Well, we look forward to seeing that. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you suspect? In a few months, a couple months?
It showed it as a. I don't mean to.
No.
But you said you didn't know.
I really don't know.
it was October. It looked like the release date was October.
In October?
Actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know.
After all your adult film work, precedes that. Because when you told me you were in Bones, I thought it was the TV show.
Oh, come on. See what he did.
Oh, sorry.
See what he just did.
He did just do an episode of Bones.
Exactly.
Which aired last week.
Which I think is a terrific series, by the way.
It was a lot of fun.
Matter of fact, you had one of the stars of Bones at your club,
That's
didn't
right.
you?
Eric Milligan, who is no longer on the show,
right.
but he was for 3 years, the young scientist on the show.
Oh, wonderful.
The first 3 years of
And That's he played at Sterling's Upstairs at Vitello's.
He did.
Which is a supper club.
He's a Broadway boy. He's from Broadway.
Yes. Yeah. I was just trying to get a plug in.
Oh,
Sterling's Upstairs. You went right back to him.
And it was so nuanced, too.
I know.
Very, like,
subtle, like a freight train.
No idea it was happening. Great.
Well, okay. Thank you, Paul.
Let's do our live arts calendar and pay the bills before we speak
Certainly.
To our next guest. Can I kick it off?
Sure.
Critically acclaimed and award-winning Theater Banshee presents Arthur Miller's timeless and timely classic, The Crucible. In the Puritan village of Salem, young women inexplicably fall sick, and suspicion turns to witchcraft and Satan. Accused witches are jailed and await hanging as neighbors turn on one another in a frenzy of paranoia. Just some light family entertainment. A thrilling tale of hysteria and hypocrisy, The Crucible stands as one of the 20th century's greatest American dramas. I would agree on that. Playing at Theater Banshee through May 15th.
In 1950s Los Angeles, tired of police harassment, back alley bars, and living in fear, a few brave souls set out to change their world and claim their civil rights in a time when nothing could be spoken in the open. Notorious communist Harry Hay and cultural icon Rudy Gernreich fell in love while building a movement. This is their story. Temperamental was code for homosexual, part of a secret survival language created by gay men in the pre-Stonewall United States. Of the recent smash off-Broadway production, the New York Times called the Temperamentals intellectual, emotional, and sexual, combining savvy, context, and descending flights of bittersweet fabulousness. The Temperamentals is playing at the Blank's Second Stage Theater through May 22nd. And Paul, we're having a guest from that show coming
on. Are we?
Yes, we are.
Who are we having?
We're having John Tartaglia.
Oh, really?
Yes, who was the Tony Award winner for Avenue Q.
Because there's another gentleman in that show who is in my favorite movie of all time, Mr. Dennis Christopher, who's in Breaking
yes,
Away.
Yes, he is,
yep.
actually.
Which is as close to a perfect movie as exists, I think, is Breaking Away. But anyway, for more information about the events in our arts calendar, you can visit either stateoftheartsla.com or performingartslive.com, where you can also check out what's happening in Southern California every day of the damn week.
And may sure. I say, I read the script for The Temperamentals, and it's an amazing script. So
And The Blank does great stuff. The Blank
yes,
Theater,
do.
I don't know, they have that wonderful Young Playwrights Festival that they do.
Yes, they
and,
do.
Lauren Davis, another friend of ours from Chicago,
yep.
is very active with The Blank
yes,
Theater.
He is.
You know who else is in that production, Paul? Is our friend Eric Bergen.
Oh, yes, who was also
yep.
on the show and also played at Sterling's Upstairs at Vitello's.
No, he did not.
But
he
another
he
good attempted
not.
Plug.
Oh. Wait a minute.
Trying to
Are
work
you
that
saying
out.
That Eric Bergen didn't play at Sterling's Upstairs
no,
at Vitello's?
No, he didn't. But we're in negotiations.
Dial 818.
So let's get on to our next guest here.
Please do.
And give him the proper introduction.
Give him the introduction
so
he deserves.
So
He's been so patient.
Most recently, our next guest directed the world premiere of Having It All at the NoHo Art Center. His directing highlights include Meet Me in St. Louis for Musical Theater West, Bell, Book, and Candle for the Colony Theater, A Christmas Carol and A Grand Night for Singing for the Norris Theater, and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels for Interact Theater Company. He is the recipient of the
2010 Los Angeles Drama Critics Circle Milton Katselis Award for career achievement in directing and is pleased to serve as the co-artistic director for West Coast Ensemble Theater. Please welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Richard Israel.
Now, Richard, I got to tell you,
yes,
because, you know, this is radio.
People can see us. Serious.
But how are you possibly old enough to have an award for career achievement?
I am amazing.
Are you that good?
I'm just so amazing is what it is, yes. I have achieved.
Because I didn't want to say anything when you brought in your own lighting.
That's how you get career achievement awards.
Although I did enjoy the slideshow in the lobby, I got to say. That was,
thank you.
It was very moving.
Took a long time to put that together.
It's a very Streisand thing to do.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, God.
So how many active shows do you have going on right now? Three?
No, just two. Two.
Just two?
Yes.
Oh, okay. The Sensational Having It All, which you haven't seen and you really have to go see. Take the Lovely Monica.
I have not seen Having It All. I love the premise, though.
And
I think the premise is genius.
You should go and see this show. It's a wonderful... Tell us about it, Richard, because I saw it, and you're the director. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, okay. Please. Having It All. Five women... all right. Well, it's basically about women and how, and I talk about this as a man, so I'm a little uncomfortable talking about the women's experience, not being one, but having directed a show that is about the women's experience. And it's really just about how women of a certain age now, who kind of came of age, you know, in the last 10, 20 years and have been kind of sold a bill of goods about how you can do everything. And
right.
if you don't do everything, then you failed.
Right.
And that a horrible disservice has kind of been done to women of this generation. And so it just looks at five women, each from kind of a different walk of life and kind of a different set of experiences. And, you know, just how they are confronting that paradigm of having been promised certain things by our culture. And it's impossible to have that delivered on. And then ultimately kind of the journey they take is that you realize that you make choices, you play the hand that you're dealt, and ultimately that is having it all. You do the best you can with what you're given, and you come through it still standing, and that ultimately is a pretty great thing, and ultimately that is basically having it all. So that's kind of the thumbnail.
And
sketch.
the whole setting, the idea of where it's placed is
right.
just genius,
yes.
especially with what you're talking about of this... time period that we live in and the transient nature of our lives and the immediacy of our lives.
Absolutely.
It's in an airport?
Yeah, it is. It's in a gate waiting area at JFK, and they are just kind of trapped there, first because their plane is delayed, and then there's a multi-city blackout, and so nobody can move, nobody can go anywhere. So it's interesting because you kind of look at it, it's a tricky convention in that you've just got these five women in one set with kind of two sets of chairs and a trash can, and you're with them for an hour and 37 minutes if things are going well. and you kind of, on the face of it, you go, oh, wow, I don't know. But it really, it's structured, it's written beautifully, and the music is pretty stunning, and you're right in there with them. And the beauty of it is that the creators have done a really, really great job, I think, of... It's very gently laid in. The storytelling and the changes that these women effect in each other are laid in super, super gently, so that what could, I think, be really didactic and really like, womanhood is hard, ends up just being very, you just latch, as an audience member, I think you really latch onto it. And what's great is that I sit in the back of the house when I see the show, and you can see when a character says something, you see the two women kind of lean over to each other and kind of nudge each other like, that's you, which is really gratifying.
The recognition.
Absolutely.
Well, you know,
yeah.
I must say to what Richard is speaking about, first of all, for me, as the theater goer in this case on your show, the energy and the excitement starts from just walking into the theater, number one,
Thank you.
Particular theater, the NoHo Arts Center in North Hollywood on Magnolia. And it's you actually, as he described the set, you know, and there's this beautiful, you know, backdrop of behind the waiting area of you know, the sky and so forth, and you hear the very subtle sounds, the airport sounds, you know, planes wow. coming in, taking off, and as it gets closer to curtain, I think that those sounds become a little bit more prominent,
well
as the show begins. And then what I found really interesting about your direction was not only are you a good director with, you know, with the actors and doing what they have to do, but you're also very inventive in using these five women in this one space. And every time there's a scene change, the set is the same, but the women are in these unusual and different positions.
Oh, wow.
All the
Thank
way
you.
Throughout the whole show.
Thank you.
And there's some work being done up above also occasionally. So I thought that was terribly inventive on your part.
It is. And, you know, you could have gone a step farther to replicate the whole airport experience by putting a Republican senator in one of the bathroom stalls.
Oh, then, well, if you came to see the show, yeah. Paul, you would know.
Okay.
And go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Which is a critical element of the show.
Oh, okay.
But all five of these women are amazing and gifted singers as well, from Jennifer Lee Warren and you know, all of the other cast of ladies, that Lindsay and all of these gals. That you really should go see this, ladies and gentlemen. It's playing, as I said, at the NoHo Arts Center in North Hollywood, and it has just had the great announcement of being extended through May 29th.
Hooray.
So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And you opened what day?
We opened... Wow, it seems so long ago now. We opened March 12th.
March 12th.
Yeah.
And if it's a David Elser production, ladies and gentlemen, who did The Marvelous Wonderettes in Los Angeles, and Life Could Be a Dream, so I would say that the prospects of this running for some time are probably very good, wouldn't you say?
I hope so.
I'm sure
yes.
So. And how to go see this, ladies and gentlemen, is very simple. You go to the NoHo Arts Center, as I said, on Magnolia in North Hollywood. Performances are Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays at 8 p.m., Sundays at 3 p.m. There is no intermission.
Correct.
In this production.
Oh, gotta love that. A musical without an intermission.
Right?
That's great. And tickets?
I'm sorry.
No, no problem.
Get the information out there. I'll stop interrupting you. But I just hate, I'm sorry, go on. It's a personal thing. Long musicals, 9 intermissions, piss me off. This doesn't have it. I'm elated. Go ahead, Michael.
All right. To that proclamation, tickets may be purchased for Having It All by calling 323, area code 960-7776.
Hate intermissions.
Or visit plays411.com or havingitallthemusical.com.
I'm so sorry.
And when did you ever
about
go
about
a musical that had 9 intermissions?
Emotional Tourette's. No, just sometimes, I mean, you mentioned the running time, and I was like, that's tight for a musical. You know, I mean, you said
it was not easy to get it.
No, and it's not. And yeah. Most people don't make the effort to do that. And I just, you know, sometimes you just, I love musicals, don't get me wrong, I love them, but it's just like sometimes they're just, I mean, we saw something a number of months ago that, was not like that. Let's just say that. And just you're sitting there like, do I have to have my mail forwarded here to the theater? I mean, what? So anyway. But I did step all over that, Michael, and I apologize for stepping all over that. So can I just throw just the number
if
on the website
out
there?
If this show closes early.
It will be my fault.
I just did it.
What?
I just did it.
No, I just wanted to throw the website out there again, not the whole thing. Just
okay.
havingitallthemusical.com, because I did just step all over what you were
and
saying.
I too must do something. I said Jennifer Lee Warren, and I did not really completely say the other ladies' names. Lindsay Alley is who I was referring to. Kim Huber, the amazing Kim Huber. Ella Taylor, who is kind of making her comeback, isn't she, with this show. And she's so wonderful.
Oh, she just... She breaks your heart the second you look at her, and she makes you pee, like all of it.
Yeah. I've got a little lotion for her. And,
She'll
Shannon,
be so pleased.
Yeah.
Speaking of pee, Scott's got a story for you.
Shannon Morn plays Amy. And again, ladies and gentlemen, treat yourself and go see this wonderful show directed by Richard Israel.
And just one of the shows that Richard
My
is involved
goodness.
With. The other one is the West Coast Ensemble production of Gypsy. That you're in rehearsals for now, right?
Yes,
you're
we
just
are.
About to open that?
We open on May 13th. Mark your calendars.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the great shows of all time.
Is there an intermission?
There is.
You know what? The night that you come see the show, no intermission.
Yeah.
We will slog right through.
That annoying guy is here. We can't do an intermission. He's like a theatrical Tourette's out there.
No intermission!
Sorry. Sorry.
But there's a twist with this, right? You're doing a little different kind of a version of this. It's kind of stripped.
Yeah, I like to think. Right? Yeah, where we are doing very, very stripped down kind of bare production of it. There's not a lot of... it's not show busy and it's not pizzazzy, and I think that that's what the show actually should be. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's just we're calling it stripped, and it's we're doing it the
which is very funny, by the way, given the
right.
Yes.
Well,
does it go over a lot of heads?
No, actually, people get it.
Oh, okay.
Well, the people that I talk to.
Okay.
You got it, right?
I got
okay,
it.
Okay.
And but I'm not the yardstick for that
well,
stuff.
Well, you know. Yeah. So we're doing it very stripped down, and we're doing it at the arena stage, the Theater of Arts Arena stage in Hollywood. So it's kind of old Broadway comes to old Hollywood, mm-hmm. and we're doing it with very little. And we're reducing the cast size. We're doing it with a 6-piece orchestra. And, like a vaudeville band. And trying to honor the vaudeville nature of the show. And I'm super excited about it because it's the perfect musical. And people say that, and I kind of went, whatever that means. But when you get into it and you realize that every single thing is handled in the text... It's remarkable what these guys did with this thing.
I'm kind of glad that it's not becoming a film now again.
You know, it's on again, off again.
Is
though.
It? I heard
yeah,
it's
check,
off
check
now
check
with
your
Barbara
watch,
Streisand doing
on.
The role. I mean,
oh, really?
I don't know. Do you think? I don't know.
I don't know, but it does make me happy that we're we're doing this way.
Oh yeah.
Which is kind of the anti-film version, just because we're doing it for $1.50.
Right.
And. And really getting to kind of the core of the story, which, it happened during the Depression. And so, I've seen productions of Gypsy where they're just wearing these great clothes and everybody looks fantastic. And it's like, where'd she get that?
Yeah.
It's 1932.
Yeah.
So we are very excited about kind of getting kind of more of the desperation of the period.
And of course, you have to have in that play, you've got to have a fantastic Mama Rose.
Oh,
I'm sure you found one, right?
We are very, very, very lucky. We're a membership theater company, and we have a member of our company who is remarkable. And
wow.
I look at her every rehearsal and just kind of thank God. So she's great.
I know your cast members are listed here, but it's not designated as to what roles they're playing. Perhaps there's a reason
so
for that?
Many
or
of them. There's just so many of them.
Yeah. Who is doing Mama Rose?
Jan Sheldrick is mm-hmm. Mama Rose. I'll just give you the highlights. Stephanie Wall is Louise. Kaylee Swanson is June. Michael Matthews is Herbie. Eric Allen Smith is Tulsa. Lots and lots of strippers, lots and lots of kids, lots and lots of dancer guys. There's just, it's a cast of 23, which I know in the broader world doesn't sound like a lot, but for us, it is mammoth.
No, 23 is,
seven of them are kids, so it's like...
Well, one of your kids is a friend of mine, actually. His father is a colleague of mine and has been for many, many years. He's one of the West Coast editors for People magazine.
Oh, L.J. Benet.
L.J. Benet. Yes. And I think you've had him in your... Wasn't
LJ
he in Big?
L.J. starred in Big.
That's
the musical, yeah.
That's right.
And we love that kid.
He is a wonderful kid.
We're really lucky. All the kids are great. And I have to say, their parents are great, because that's the thing, that, like, kids are easy, parents not so much. But we are so lucky with these parents. They're, like, amazing and very, very savvy to all of us.
And kind of ironic, given the subject matter of the show.
A little bit, because I'm, like, waiting for the real-life Mama Rose to surface, and so far, so good.
I have a little name dropping to do.
Do you?
I actually was friends with June Havoc. Thank you very
much. Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes,
right.
Because she lived in New Georgetown, Connecticut. I lived in Richfield. Scott, you know that area there.
Indeed.
And I did a production of Jesus Christ Superstar that she attended, and she was very complimentary. And we
thank
sort
God
of
I
became...
thought you were going to say that she was in.
No, she wasn't in it.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
it was a very it was Jesus Christ Superstar stripped.
And with June Havoc as Judas,
and
it was amazing.
No, Mary Magdalene had not aged well. So but she was a lovely woman. She was just lovely and just pure elegance and just great.
Oh,
and,
They
shoot horses, don't they? And that whole aspect of her life, of she did all those marathon.
Marathons.
She wrote a play. Didn't she write a play about it called Marathon 21 or something like that? But she wrote a play about how during the Depression and how brutal that was on people.
And she was quite famous as a dance marathon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Professional. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what she went on to after the story of Gypsy leaves off. June Havoc went right into dance marathons.
Mm. Yeah. And, she was a lovely woman. She was a lovely woman.
I wonder why someone never went on to make a sequel to that show, you know, given the fact that June went on and had a
I don't know
a career.
You,
and
I don't think you can.
No?
That, no, I think that that show is, it just, once you've done
A sequel
Rose's
to Gypsy?
Turn,
well, I mean, because it does leave Dainty June, you know, kind of hanging there. And
well, there actually really is a sequel to Gypsy.
What's that,
It's
Paul?
Called Tramps and Thieves.
Sorry.
Oh,
it's
there.
Really
thing on.
Reachy.
Tragically, that thing is on, yes.
I'm so sorry.
Wow.
So, you're sorry.
There goes.
All I know, there is a sequel to Gypsy, and there's no friggin' intermission.
Good Lord.
And the podcast stopped downloading just before 100,000. Paul never reaches
yes.
it.
Yes.
So sad.
We've been at 99,000 for just 6 years.
That's it.
Well, I, Richard, will be there to
Good.
See your show.
We would
because
love for you to be
I
there.
Am very excited that you're doing this. And I've often said to myself, why isn't anybody doing this, you know, in town on this level of equity right. waiver and making something very special?
It's as, a, I, well, I think it's do. A scary prop. I mean, well, I don't think so. I know so. It's a scary proposition because it's a giant, giant thing.
Mm-hmm.
To do so, I get why people haven't done it. I just don't get why we're doing it.
Yeah, see,
that's a soundbite right there.
But in paying all due respect to you, you've taken these big shows and you've done them in these smaller spaces, and they've all worked so beautifully.
And that's just it. It's not a matter of doing them big. It's a matter of doing them well.
And that's exactly what he does. And and because I think you were out of the El Centro, weren't you?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And that's a That space is about as big as this table.
Yeah.
So,
I want to get this information out here, too. Gypsy will preview on Wednesday, May 11th and Thursday, May 12th at 8 p.m. and will open on Friday, May 13th and continue through Sunday, July 3rd at the Theater of Arts Arena Stage, and that is 1625 North Las Palmas Avenue in Hollywood. I'm sure it will be on all the related Gold Star and Performing Arts Live
yes.
and all of those LA Stage Alliance different things. So, gonna get that information out there. We got 5 minutes left, Michael.
Did you give him a telephone number for tickets?
I didn't have a telephone number in front of me.
Do
you have it?
Yes, I do. Well,
okay.
There's two ways to do it. WestCoastEnsemble.org, ladies and gentlemen, or tix.com, or by calling 323-655-0108, Gypsy Stripped. Be
okay.
there.
There we go. I'm sorry, I didn't see that. Okay.
Okay,
gentlemen, we got 5 minutes left. We always like to wrap up our hour with sharing some theatrical nightmare stories. The last time that Scott was here, he had a fascinating story about sitting in a cardboard box and peeing himself, which was truly just inspiring.
Kind of hard to top
Thank
that.
You.
Yes. And I'm hoping we can top that today. Either you want to kick it off, Scott, you got something, anything in mind?
Well, that's my best. I mean, I gave you my best last time. I mean,
you didn't know you were coming back.
No,
did
I didn't know I was coming back.
Okay.
I don't like to leave him wanting. No, you know, the only other thing I could think of was once doing a show in Chicago. So I was a little older than 12 years old.
That's right. It did happen when he was 12.
Oh,
thank you.
So
thank you. Yeah,
it didn't happen recently.
No. That's why, I mean, he interestingly edited that part out in relating that.
He was peeing because there was no intermission.
Oh, Mr. Rats.
You have a choice. I know.
And this, yeah, exactly. The, you know, this involves one of those, you know, starting to laugh on stage stories, which we've shared a few moments of, Paul,
yes, we
I believe,
have.
And kind of not being able to stop. And this one was my fault, and it was during a play that was it was called The White Rose, and it was about based on a true story of these group of young medical students, German medical students during World War II, who were actually opposed to the Nazis, and started. Putting out a pamphlet called The White Rose, letting their opposition of the Nazis know, and they were found out, and they were caught and beheaded. So it's a lovely tale. But we got very bored doing it, and I don't know why. And it was a bunch of, you know, some knuckleheads who I could name all their names, and you would know them and understand why this happened. But I started creating different subtexts for each of the shows, you know, the secret that one of the characters had, and, you know, one, you know, like that my dog had died and I didn't know it, so everybody was coming up to me and kind of putting their hand on my shoulder, and whatever their actual line of dialogue was, they would say it with a look in their eye, like, oh, you poor guy. And so I had come up with a subtext one night that ended up being rather dangerous, and we got to a point in the show where everyone was doing very, very well, though we got to one point that was supposed to be a very dramatic part in the show, but it just cracked everybody up on stage, and I actually had to walk off the stage because I couldn't stop laughing, and we all went backstage, and we fell down, and we probably were peeing, so maybe there was urine involved in it, and we just had a grand time, and we were so proud of ourselves, and we came off stage afterwards. There was a post-show discussion, and as we, the students, kind of walked on stage, some other actors were already there, we heard a woman in the audience with a very thick German accent saying, you know, I knew these people, I knew these students, and they were not as flippant as they were. And she started going on and on about these things, and we all just went beet red and felt god-awful. And it turned out she was talking more about the writing, and it wasn't really but we felt terrible that here's this woman who had said, you know, she had managed to survive Hitler, and yet we...
And yet we offended her.
Yes. So there's a little nightmare story for you.
Nice work.
Thank you.
Nice work.
Thank you.
Richard Israel.
What do you got,
Richard?
Mine's not nearly that good, and I don't think it offended anybody. But could have. This is years ago.
I was at this production of The White Rose.
There I was, and I was so offended. That's my story. This is back when I was acting, and I did a production of The Human Comedy, which is a musical version of the Mickey Rooney film, and it is a through-sung musical, which is hard, even worse than shows with intermissions, is that it's just through-sung. So it's just, as an audience member, it's just difficult to sit through a through-sung musical. And there is one moment that is not sung. It's a moment of silence, a beautiful moment between me and my kind of faux older brother. We finally stop singing, and we look at each other, and we're looking at each other in each other's eyes like, okay, you're going to be my new brother, and it's all very, very quiet. And you just hear from the second row, ugh, this is endless. And I hear that woman's voice in my head to this day when I'm directing, and I'm like, okay, is this endless?
I love
it
that.
It was genius.
I love that.
That woman is somewhere in this world right now. She has no idea what she has provided me.
Kevin Tice, a friend of ours from Chicago, we only got like 30 seconds left, but Kevin Tice from Chicago talks about doing a production of Curse of the Starving Class where he had to come on stage naked. And he goes, and it's not bad coming on stage naked because it's such a gradual walk out, and you turn and it's all revealed, and you know it's a very charged moment. He said, unless there's an elderly woman in the front row who's had her face down in the program for your entire walk out, and then decides to look up when your genitals are about 4 feet away from her face. So it's just like he walks out and it's all quiet, and she's got her program. It's just like this. And, oh my God! He goes, boy, that's a long cross off after that.
And you could take that two ways.
You certainly could.
Yes, you could. Yes,
that
you
might
could.
Not be bad.
We have to wrap it up, Michael.
We do. Gentlemen, thank
have,
you so much for,
who we have
for
coming?
Joining us. I will indeed, Paul. Please join us, ladies and gentlemen, in the coming weeks when we will be chatting with Michael Orland, musical director of American Idol, as well as Academy Award-winning composer, the one and only Mr. Richard Sherman. Ali Willis will be with us in weeks to come, who certainly wrote The Color Purple and many other wonderful
And Suzanne
things.
Wong.
We'll and Suzanne Wong is yes, coming we'll back to see us. Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen. Pleasure having both of you on.
Thank you.
Indeed.
And we will see you all next week.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.